This podcast is sponsored by IQ Bar.
I've got good news and bad news. Here's the bad news. Most protein bars are packed with sugar and unpronounceable ingredients. The good news? There's a better option. I'm Will, and I created IQ Bar Plant Protein Bars to empower doers like you with clean, delicious, low-sugar brain and body fuel. IQ Bars are packed with 12 grams of protein, brain nutrients like magnesium and lion's mane, and zero weird stuff. And right now, you can get 20% off all IQ Bar products, plus free shipping. Try our delicious IQ Bar sampler pack with 7 plant protein bars, 4 hydration mixes, and 4 enhanced coffee sticks. Clean ingredients, amazing taste, and you'll love how you feel. Refuel smarter, hydrate harder, caffeinate larger with IQ Bar.
Go to eatiqbar.com and enter code BAR20 to get 20% off all IQ Bar products, plus free shipping. Again, go to eatiqbar.com and enter code BAR20.
We've now wrapped up our study of the Secret Service, one of the many alleged plotters that we'll be covering during this third season of Solving JFK. Next, we'll be moving on to J. Edgar Hoover and the FBI. But before we do that, I wanted to take an episode to cover some major breaking news and developments around the JFK assassination, namely the release of many of the remaining classified documents as ordered by President Trump and the congressional hearing on the JFK assassination on April 1st. Coming up next on Solving JFK.
In Dallas, Texas, 3 shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade in downtown Dallas. The first reports say that President Kennedy has been seriously wounded by this shooting.
The flash, apparently official, President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time.
I don't know what this is all about.
Dallas police this morning resumed custody. The man they have formally charged with the assassination of President Kennedy.
Oswald acting alone, or was he a member of a conspiracy? Commission answers, he acted alone.
This is Solving JFK. I'm your host, Matt Crumpton. In mid-February, I got a call from the House Oversight Committee asking if I would be able to assist in the upcoming hearings on the JFK assassination. Of course, I was honored to even be considered, and I volunteered to help in whatever way I could. After that initial contact, the next time I heard back was a few weeks later when I was asked if I would be willing to testify to the committee. I said I would be happy to speak if they wanted to hear from me, and also let them know that while I do have citations for all propositions of fact, there are a lot of people who have been studying the JFK assassination much longer than I have. Ultimately, the committee chose 3 excellent JFK assassination scholars for the April 1st hearing: Jefferson Morley, Oliver Stone, and Jim DiEugenio, and also invited me to attend as a guest, which is how I landed the front row seat with my face and my red tie hilariously behind Jim DiEugenio. This was a very, look mom, I'm on TV type of moment. In a recent bonus episode with Andrew Eiler, we touched on the work that was being done by the Congressional Oversight Committee, headed up by Congresswoman Ana Paulina Luna. The committee has endeavored to cover many topics that are considered to be shrouded in government secrecy, with the JFK assassination being just one. The April 1st hearing was dedicated to only the JFK assassination. Aside from Jefferson, Oliver, and Jim, there was also a privacy expert on the panel named John Davison, who spoke about the unauthorized disclosure of Social Security numbers. Each speaker was able to give a 6-minute statement, and then each committee member had 5 minutes to ask questions. Here are a few highlights from the hearing.
Mr. Morley, I want to start with you first. You said, according to your testimony, in asking what did the CIA know and when did they know it, what do you think that is? What is the answer to that question?
What did the president, what did the CIA know about Lee Harvey Oswald, and when did they know it?
Mm-hmm.
A whole lot. 198 pages worth of information were on the CIA's desk when President Kennedy left for Dallas. So that that foundational fact should guide us in understanding what happened.
So who do you think fired the shot?
I don't know.
You don't know, but you don't believe it was Lee Harvey Oswald?
Oswald was not the intellectual author of Kennedy's death, even if he fired a gun that day.
Who do you think was the intellectual author of Kennedy's death?
Kennedy's enemies high in his own government is as specific as I can be based on the available evidence. Mm-hmm. Probably CIA and Pentagon.
I now recognize Mr. DiEugenio for an opening statement.
The JFK case is one that simply will not go away, no matter how much MSM tries to minimize it or make it disappear. 65% of the public does not buy the Warren Commission verdict of Oswald as the lone assassin. But even more startling, over 90% of the public believes that something monumental happened after the Kennedy assassination, that the United States went from a country that was bathed in triumphant optimism after World War II to one that was now covered with cynicism and skepticism. It's a cliche, but it's true. Secrecy is the enemy of democracy. It's the enemy of the Republican form of government. And misinformed or uninformed public cannot make good decisions. And a compliant press helps cushion the public from that fact. And this process leads to a loss of belief in both the government and the media. And you can examine every poll out there, okay, and they'll tell you that. When President Kennedy took office, 75% of the public believed in what the government was saying. By the 90s, it was down to 19%.
I now recognize Mr. Stone for an opening statement.
I asked the committee to reopen what the Warren Commission failed miserably to complete. I ask you in good faith, outside all political considerations, to reinvestigate the assassination of this President Kennedy from the scene of the crime to the courtroom, which means, which never happened, but which means the chain of custody on the rifle, the bullets, the fingerprints, the autopsy that defies belief, and then, and that if it were a murder, we'd have given to the poorest man dying in a gutter. Let us reinvestigate the fingerprints of intelligence all over Lee Harvey Oswald from 1959 to 1960, his violent death in 1963. And most importantly, this CIA, whose muddy footprints are all over this case, a true interrogation. James Angleton, before he died, who was one of the original members of the CIA, was talking about Dulles and Helms and the others, what he called the Grand Masters. And he's a Catholic. Angleton was a Catholic in search, perhaps, of repentance before his death. He did say, quote, if you were in a room with them, you were in a room full of people that you had to believe would deservedly end up in hell. I guess I will see them soon. This is our democracy. This is our presidency. It belongs to us. Treat us with respect.
From the vantage point of being only a few feet away from the speakers, these are my major takeaways from the hearing. The moving parts of the JFK assassination are complex. It's a lot to ask of a congressperson to understand the amount that they would need to know about the case to ask the right questions. This is just one more reason why we need to have a new investigation to put out a final report on what the assassination records tell us now that they've pretty much all been declassified. And this is what Oliver Stone called for during his testimony. Now, the forum of a congressional hearing where every congressperson gets 5 minutes is not well suited to laying out the current state of the case. But I have to believe that there's a more productive way to do it. Jefferson Morley is known as somebody who does not overstate facts. He's a reliable reporter, in my view. When Morley said that Lee Harvey Oswald did not kill President Kennedy, that was a big deal. It was also major when he explained that three CIA officers, Helms, Angleton, and Joannides, all lied to the government under oath regarding Oswald. The most disappointing aspect of the hearing was the partisan nature of the interest in the assassination. The Republicans certainly have more to learn about this very complicated case, as demonstrated by Congresswoman Lauren Boebert asking Oliver Stone questions about a book that was written by Roger Stone. But the Democrats on the committee, with the exception of Chairman Garcia, really had no interest in talking to the speakers about the case. Instead, they used the hearing to talk about current-day partisan political issues. They also rightfully condemned the release of documents with Social Security numbers of living people, something that impacted a few dozen Americans. Yes, that was bad, and everyone agrees that that was bad. Still, the committee Dems' position seemed to be that it was a waste of time to even be talking about the JFK assassination, which recently has not been a partisan issue. Remember, the original leading researchers in this case, people like Mark Lane and Harold Weisberg, were mostly progressive Democrats. Everyone wanted to know what was the big find in the new records that have just come out. But this is, of course, a major ongoing endeavor. Most of these documents were previously redacted, which means that we have to find the original redacted document so that we can understand what information has just come out. That's a process that takes a long time. I was able to get an interview with two of the speakers in a rush hour Uber going from the Capitol to DuPont Circle. Here's what they said.
Jim, this is your first time testifying before Congress, right, today?
Yes, it is.
Okay. And it seemed to go pretty well, got a lot of good information on the record. How did that go versus kind of how you thought it was going to go?
Well, you know, I thought it was very interesting today because it was really nice to have nobody attacking you. You know, it was, you know, everybody seemed either in favor or kind of neutral about what we were doing. And the Congresswoman Luna, I thought she was just excellent. The questions she had for Oliver right off the bat, I thought were very interesting questions. And I think that got us off to a really kind of good start, you know, in front of Congress.
Yeah, good. And Oliver, you have testified before Congress before, famously, when JFK first came out. How do you think today went, and how was that kind of weird to be back up there again?
Yeah, I come back every 20, 30 years and, and ask the same things over again and over again. You know, I called today outrageously for a new complete investigation from the ground up. I love that. You're pissing in the wind, but... You know, what I'm saying is it went good. It went okay. I think those young Congress people are far more less politicized than the older generation, and maybe they will do something, you know, would be nice.
Do you guys have any particular aspirations or hopes for what happens next with kind of where we are?
Listen, ask me when I'm 89 or 90, maybe 100, okay? Come back and ask me.
Okay.
Again.
All right, what about you, Jim?
Well, you know, Oliver actually did something very daring today. He asked the committee to actually open up a new investigation, which, I mean, that's really out there. But Luna, the chairwoman of the committee, is very fair and very interested in this case, you know. So I hope she's actually talking about a second meeting.
Yeah.
She wants to have a second meeting. You know, so maybe she actually is going to take that seriously. Well, that'd be terrific if she did.
They have to, because they announced that they're going to do three investigations on the three murders. So, right. I mean, come on. That's the least they can do. But hopefully they're smart. And I think we presented some good information today. Morley was great with his, you know, he's more of a journalist mainstream. He doesn't want to cross one one narrow step across, you know, because he'll get attacked by all his colleagues at the New York Times, blah, blah. And Jim was great. And I, of course, bring up the rear, you know.
This podcast is sponsored by IQBar. I've got good news and bad news. Here's the bad news. Most protein bars are packed with sugar and unpronounceable ingredients. The good news? There's a better option. I'm Will, and I created IQBar plant protein bars to empower doers like you with clean, delicious, low-sugar brain and body fuel. IQ bars are packed with 12 grams of protein, brain nutrients like magnesium and lion's mane, and zero weird stuff. And right now, you can get 20% off all IQ bar products, plus free shipping. Try our delicious IQ bar sampler pack with 7 plant protein bars, 4 hydration mixes, and 4 enhanced coffee sticks. Clean ingredients, amazing taste, and you'll love how you feel. Refuel smarter. Hydrate harder, caffeinate larger with IQ Bar.
Go to eatiqbar.com and enter code BAR20 to get 20% off all IQ Bar products plus free shipping. Again, go to eatiqbar.com and enter code BAR20.
On March 18th, the first trove of newly declassified JFK assassination records was released. There were 3,886 records still classified. But as of the recording of this podcast, 2,359 of those records have been released, leaving just 1,527 still withheld. I'm unclear on the exact status of those still classified documents. But we know that there are a few important documents with redactions that are still awaiting an unredacted version to be released. These include Bill Harvey's travel records for the fall of 1963 and the George Joannides file. The question everyone wants answered is, what's the biggest find in the new documents? Is there a smoking gun? First, we have to remember that we're talking about 80,000 pages, and again, we have to cross-reference the newly released clean documents with the previously redacted documents to find out exactly what was censored before. Of course, on top of that, to be able to make sense of these new releases, you would have to know many detailed aspects of the case inside out. In other words, it's going to take a while before the JFK research community can fully digest these document releases. Having said that, I did want to go ahead and provide an overview of some of the most interesting documents that I've seen that have come out over the last month. Without further delay, these are my top 10 2025 JFK assassination document releases so far. Number 10 is James Angleton's unredacted church committee testimony. When former CIA counterintelligence chief James Angleton testified to the church committee in June of 1975, we now know from one line that has been unredacted that Angleton introduced Bill Harvey to the Israelis. Now, the mere fact of this introduction is not a big deal. But the previously classified line of the transcript says, quote, "I had introduced Harvey as the only officer to the Israeli operational people on the Cuban business." So the question here is, what does it mean that Bill Harvey was introduced to Israeli operational people as it relates to the Cuban business? Harvey led efforts against Cuba during Operation Mongoose. So does this mean that there was Israeli operational support or involvement during Mongoose? We don't know that from this document, but it does raise that question. Number 9, a September 1996 CIA memo about Oswald in Japan. Tip of the hat to my friend Max Good for bringing this to my attention. The memo says that a local UPI reporter in Japan was about to file a story about Oswald being recruited by the CIA while he was stationed in Japan. The story was based on an interview with a retired Marine officer who claimed to be Oswald's commander in Japan. The previously redacted section of this document says, quote, "As a long shot at keeping a CIA-related story from surfacing in Japan, thereby prompting Japanese journalists to pursue the same information, Chief of Station suggested to the press officer that she pass the number of the historical office at headquarters responsible for dealing with public queries to the reporter, advising that his scoop may, in fact, be old news." Now, what puzzles me here is that the CIA is focusing its critique of the story on the fact that it isn't a new story that Oswald allegedly was recruited in Japan by the CIA. And the part that looks like it was previously redacted talks about wanting to stop Japanese journalists from looking into it. This, of course, raises the question, why would the CIA be against, quote, Japanese journalists pursuing the same information if there was no truth to the information in the first place? Number 8 is a May 21st, 1982 letter from David Blee, who was the counterintelligence chief of the CIA at the time. This letter is in response to questions about Valery Kostikov. You may remember Kostikov from when we covered Oswald's alleged trip to Mexico City. Kostikov met with a man who claimed to be Lee Harvey Oswald. Whether it actually was Oswald is not proven and remains disputed. The historical understanding has been that Kostikov was the head of the Soviet Union's Department 13, which handled assassinations in the Western Hemisphere. Of course, Oswald meeting with the head of Soviet assassinations only a month before the president was killed seems to imply that Oswald may have killed the president and that he may have done it at the behest or at least with the knowledge of the Soviet Union. But this new document from David Blee seems to cast doubt on the historical understanding of Kostikov's role and says, quote, "Although our file indicates that Kostikov may have been a member of Department 13, Executive Action, we have been unable to confirm this. Also, to the best of our knowledge, the KGB has not engaged in such executive action since 1959. So what does the CIA really think about Kostikov? I'm not sure. And maybe that's why James Angleton called intelligence work a wilderness of mirrors. Number 7, the Regis Blahut security investigation file from the HSCA. While we have not yet covered it on Solving JFK, the research community has long known about an incident where CIA officer Regis Blahut was caught breaking into a safe used by the House Select Committee on Assassinations. The safe was used for storing important evidence, including autopsy photos. During the break-in, nothing was taken, but the autopsy photos were tampered with. Specifically, the photos of President Kennedy's head wound had been taken out of their slip cases and were left in disarray. We know that it was Regis Blahut from the CIA who broke into the safe because the HSCA took it very seriously and had fingerprints taken by the DC police. At first, Blahut denied it, but later, he admitted to breaking into the safe. The CIA said that Blahut was just curious, and that's why he broke into the evidence safe. We now have the complete file on Blahut's HSCA safe break-in. It's a 159-page document, so I haven't had the time to ascertain exactly what sections were previously redacted. Still, what jumps out at me is the handwritten note on the first page of the file that says, quote, "This file is of an unusual nature because it deals with an incident involving a CIA employee and this committee. It has not been logged into our system by agreement with the CIA." In other words, The HSCA found a security breach, but then covered it up because they had an agreement with the CIA to do that. Of course, it didn't end up making a difference that the file wasn't logged into the system because the story was eventually reported anyway. But it does raise the question as to why the HSCA would even have such an agreement with the CIA. And it also makes you wonder what Blahut was really doing with those autopsy photos in the safe. On a related note, Dan Hardaway, one of the primary HSCA investigators, recently relayed to journalist Jeff Meek that he was offered a job by the CIA when he started working with the HSCA to investigate the CIA. Hardaway turned the CIA job down and reported back to his boss at the HSCA about the CIA approaching him. The officer who wanted Hardaway to work at CIA at the same time he was investigating it was Regis Blahut. Number 6. Two documents that bring light to Priscilla Johnson McMillan's relationship with the CIA. We covered Priscilla Johnson McMillan so far in the context of her meeting with Oswald for an interview in the Soviet Union about 2 weeks after Oswald arrived there. We also noted that journalist Aline Mosby told the HSCA that McMillan worked for the CIA. It's also true that when McMillan testified to the HSCA, for some reason, she had immunity from prosecution. Now, we have two recently declassified documents that further clarify McMillan's relationship with the CIA. The first one is a May 1962 request by CIA to approve Priscilla Johnson, this is before she was married, as a news editor for China Quarterly and Encounter, two publications subsidized by the CIA. The document says, quote, "Subject has been of previous interest to the agency, though she has not been hired by either a proprietary operation or used in any FI project. Subject subsequent to clearance and hire will be considered by the project for possible reassignment into more responsible work." So we know that as of 1962, the CIA was aware of her and she was actively an asset under Project QK Opera per this newly released document. The other unredacted document on Priscilla Johnson McMillan is 4 pages of notes from the HSCA staffer who interviewed her that conclusively demonstrate that Priscilla McMillan had an ongoing relationship with the CIA throughout her career up to that time. The last note says, quote, "January 5, 1975, PJ Whitting collaborator." So why should we care about Priscilla Johnson McMillan's background? She's the one who wrote the official biography of Marina Oswald, which is relied upon heavily and viewed as the gold standard by the mainstream press and academic historians. We now know with certainty that the woman who wrote Marina Oswald's biography was a Whitting collaborator of the CIA in 1975, which means that her book, written in 1977, cannot be regarded as an honest attempt to capture what actually happened, and should instead be looked at as CIA propaganda. Number 5. Two CIA documents about what Cubans thought happened to President Kennedy. These are in the form of CIA memos that document what was overheard when listening to Cubans. The first one is written on the day of the assassination and was previously withheld in full. This memo says that after President Kennedy was killed, the head of the Cuban embassy in Chile, Pedro Martinez Perez, said, quote, "The person arrested was president of a Fair Play for Cuba committee, and that if the Yankees or CIA assassinated Kennedy to resume the assault on Cuba, then a third world war would start. He said things are very clear, and there is no doubt that they have assassinated him. The contradictions are well defined, and the moment was very special, like that of the Maine. The other document is a 1994 internal CIA memo that says, quote, "In 1969, an informant personally saw Fidel Castro meet with a group of U.S. radicals. Castro talked to them for 2 hours about why just one assassin could not possibly have killed Kennedy. Castro ordered a reenactment of the crime using his best marksmen, and they could not duplicate what Lee Harvey Oswald supposedly did by himself." So why do we care about memos capturing what people from the Cuban government thought? They weren't there, so there's no reason that we should trust them to know what happened. But on the other hand, what possible basis could there be to keep these documents classified for all of these years? The fact that the first memo is from the day of the assassination and specifically mentions the Maine, a ship that was sunk as part of a false flag operation to start the Spanish-American War, makes me wonder if the real reason why this document remained withheld for so long is that the Cubans got it right on the first day. Number 4. The fully declassified June 30th, 1961 Arthur Schlesinger memo about reorganizing the CIA. This document was the result of President Kennedy famously saying after the failed Bay of Pigs invasion that he would, quote, "splinter the CIA in 1,000 pieces and scatter it to the wind." Kennedy's advisor, Schlesinger, drafted this memo to lay out the practical considerations for reorganizing the CIA. For years, a large portion of the memo was redacted. Really, we could do an entire episode just on this memo alone. But to keep it high level, here is the summary of what we now know from the declassified section. CIA officers had historically used the State Department as cover abroad. However, by 1961, things were getting out of hand. 47% of political officers serving in U.S. embassies abroad were CIA. This had the result of the CIA effectively taking control over foreign policy from the State Department in some places. For example, in France, the president of the National Assembly would only speak with the CIA, not the ambassador. I wouldn't be surprised if there are numerous CIA officers who continue to work under State Department cover today. And that could have been a good reason, sources and methods, to keep part of this memo classified. But there's also another part of the memo that was previously redacted that looks at the heart of President Kennedy's concern with the CIA. It says, quote, "The contemporary CIA possesses many of the characteristics of a state within a state. CIA operations have not been held effectively subordinate to United States foreign policy." The memo goes on to say, quote, "Though CIA's autonomy developed for historical reasons, it has been able to endure because there is no doctrine governing our conduct of clandestine operations. The problem of doctrine for CIA is the extent to which its various clandestine missions are compatible with a free and open society." I understand why the CIA taking over the State Department with undercover officers was withheld for a long time, but there was no reason whatsoever to withhold Schlesinger's view, shared by President Kennedy, about the concerns with the CIA not being compatible with a free and open society. If the CIA had nothing to hide, why would it censor this information for so long? Is the CIA really that thin-skinned, or did it have something to hide? Number 3, a November 27th, 1962 memo from Bill Harvey. In this document, Bill Harvey, who led CIA's Operation Mongoose against Cuba, laments that because of JFK's post-Cuban Missile Crisis assurances to Cuba, quote, "These assurances will preclude any meaningful CIA action on a phased basis to provoke a revolt inside Cuba." It's hard to tell exactly what was previously redacted in this document, but from the underlining, it appears that it was this section. Quote, "In view of these factors, the so-called Track 2 course of action, i.e., unlimited support of Cuban exiles and exile groups with no real control or objective purposes, in the hope that these groups will be able to shake the Castro regime, will, although unrealistic, become increasingly attractive at various levels in the United States government." What I take from this is that Bill Harvey is saying that since Kennedy promised peace with the Cubans, others in the government who disagree with him are going to want to limitlessly fund the Cubans for no reason other than to make it hard for Kennedy to keep the peace. The fact that the head of Operation Mongoose is saying that people inside Kennedy's own government would be willing to work against him, even though it was unrealistic, shows just how much the, quote, various levels of the government, as Harvey put it, did not view themselves as having to follow the president's directives when it came to Cuba. Number two, James Angleton's declassified HSCA transcript. This document shows that Angleton lied under oath about what he knew regarding Lee Harvey Oswald while President Kennedy was still alive. Angleton had put Oswald under mail surveillance, which is also called mail coverage, in November of 1959 as part of HT Lingual. We covered this in season two. Reuben Efron is the CIA officer who ran the mail coverage program for Angleton. In the newly available testimony, Angleton is asked, quote, "To your knowledge, was Oswald ever the subject of any CIA project?" Angleton responded, "No." Then Angleton is asked if he knows Reuben Efron, who led the mail coverage program, and Angleton says yes. To Jefferson Morley's point, this document absolutely establishes that James Angleton lied to the HSCA under oath. Official story defenders will argue that Angleton probably just forgot, but it's harder to take that position given that the information was classified for so long. If it didn't matter, then why hide it all these years? Number one, a January 22, 1958 memo from Alan Belmont at the FBI. This document is also about mail coverage. The memo says that the FBI discovered a mailing address that was used by illegal Soviet agents all over the world, and the Bureau wanted to get mail coverage on that address. This led to James Angleton contacting the FBI about the existing CIA mail coverage operation, HT Lingual. What's interesting about this newly unredacted memo is what Angleton told the FBI about the purpose of the CIA's mail coverage program, which, as you may recall, included Lee Harvey Oswald. The memo says, quote, "Angleton further indicated that the coverage has been in existence in excess of a year, and he stated that the sole purpose for the coverage was to identify persons behind the Iron Curtain who might have some ties in the U.S. who could be approached in their countries as contacts and sources for CIA. Angleton indicated that CIA had successfully developed several sources through this means." In other words, about a year and a half before Oswald began having his mail read, James Angleton is on the record saying that the only reason the mail reading program exists is to identify contacts and sources for the CIA. This document raises the question of whether Oswald did in fact become a contact or a source for the CIA, if he wasn't already one at the time the CIA began to read his mail. Next time on Solving JFK, we continue asking the question, if not Oswald, then who? And we turn our attention to J. Edgar Hoover and the FBI. If you heard anything that you believe is out of context, or if you have additional information to offer, you can let us know at solvingjfkpodcast@gmail.com. Please provide citations to the record for any fact that you're relying on. For transcripts, sources, and official podcast merchandise, visit solvingjfkpodcast.com.
In Dallas, Texas, three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade in downtown Dallas.
The flash, apparently official, President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time.
Thanks for listening. Visit solvingjfkpodcast.com for more information.
This podcast is sponsored by IQ Bar.
I've got good news and bad news. Here's the bad news. Most protein bars are packed with sugar and unpronounceable ingredients. The good news? There's a better option. I'm Will, and I created IQ Bar Plant Protein Bars to empower doers like you with clean, delicious, low-sugar brain and body fuel. IQ Bars are packed with 12 grams of protein, brain nutrients like magnesium and lion's mane, and zero weird stuff. And right now, you can get 20% off all IQ Bar products, plus free shipping. Try our delicious IQ Bar sampler pack with 7 plant protein bars, 4 hydration mixes, and 4 enhanced coffee sticks. Clean ingredients, amazing taste, and you'll love how you feel. Refuel smarter, hydrate harder, caffeinate larger with IQ Bar.
Go to eatiqbar.com and enter code BAR20 to get 20% off all IQ Bar products, plus free shipping. Again, go to eatiqbar.com and enter code BAR20.